You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends.
Last night, brief light, 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space on such a timeless flight.
The amazing Elton John with Rocket Man. I'm a big fan of Elton's music. You'll tell to this week we have got a certain theme with the music as well as the film we're going to be talking about later, which is all connected to what, David?
It's all connected to the works of a great writer, Ray Bradbury, who I think is sadly no longer with us. But yeah, that's what we're talking about and looking at this month.
So this Stone Tapes, are talking about Ray Bradbury, and later on, Something Wicked This Way Comes. And in the studio today, we've got with us Patricia H. Ash.
Hello.
George Mann.
Hello.
David, of course.
Yeah, I'm here. Hi.
And myself, I'm here too. Hi.
Who are you?
And I'm Sam Stone.
Are you sure? Are you sure about that? I'm not sure you are sure. You were last month.
I am sometimes, and sometimes I'm somebody else.
You are. I'm not quite sure about this.
I'm not sure about this either.
Fantastic.
George, what have we got on the manufacture this month?
I'm recently back from a trip to San Diego.
We're not jealous.
For Comic-Con.
Not even a little bit.
Even a little bit jealous. Not at all.
So I thought that might be a great opportunity to talk about that convention, the experience of the trip, and maybe just a bit about conventions in general.
Because it's a phenomenal event, isn't it, the San Diego? It's one of the biggest, the most well-known, probably.
I think it's 140,000 people pass through.
Good grief.
It opens on the Thursday night Wednesday night for preview night, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So it's four full days.
And they packed, I guess.
Yeah, and it gets increasingly busy until Sunday afternoon, really. The first time I went last year, I went on the preview night expecting it to be fairly quiet, and it was packed. And I couldn't believe it. And people kept saying to me, you just wait. And then Friday was busy, and then the Saturday, it was your shuffle walk. And this thing is set in this convention hall that's a mile from one end to the other. It's epic. There's whole zones dedicated to different parts of the genre. So you've got a big computer game area, loads of TV studios, and that's one of the kind of the interesting things for me. They still call it a Comic-Con, but it's actually there's as much there about TV, toys, games.
Because I'd heard it was very much more sort of media orientated, the San Diego one, purely because the big studios had kind of seen it as a great opportunity to release and publicise new films and do trailers and let people know it was coming out. And all that kind of thing. So there's a big kind of studio interest.
I think they see it as a target audience because obviously there's increasing amounts of TV and film are based on comic books. Mm. On the DC stand, I was there for them unveiling the Wonder Woman trailer, and I literally couldn't move. I was between meetings, and I'd gone and stood there and got squashed.
Gosh.
But then Gal Gadot came out, Chris Pine as well, and they had this big screen between them, and they put the trailer on for the first time. Wow. And it was a brilliant experience.
But how many people could actually see that?
Probably 500 people on that, crushed into that stand. It was live, and it was going live on the internet at the same time.
Right.
But we were there to see the actors, annoyingly, everyone sticks their phones in the air trying to take pictures.
No.
All you can see is this sea of screens.
Pictures. Yeah. You can see lots of little actors
of the actors. although I did get a bit of a glimpse between people's arms,
Yes.
But that was kind of the only celebrity bit that I attended. I did walk past the Warner Brothers stand when the Gotham cast was signing as well, and saw Sean Pertwee and a few others there.
Wow. And
they were keeping the public back, really, and had a queue for people.
So why were you there, George?
I was there really to promote my comics, because obviously I've been doing Doctor Who comics, and we're launching the new Warhammer 40,000 comics as well. So I went to do a Warhammer panel, a big Doctor Who and Torchwood
panel. So
you say
we, is this Titan who's doing
this? Yes, I was there on my own as a creator, but I was attached to Titan in terms of a lot of the publicity I was doing.
Right.
So I did a panel with my editor, Andrew, on Warhammer. Did a signing with Kevin Scott because we've co-written a Cyberman story, which was launching there as well, and then a Doctor Who and Torchwood panel where we had John Barrowman talking to the audience about his Torchwood comics as well, and we talked about Doctor Who.
And so were these all kind of also very well attended? I mean, I'm assuming they were.
I was amazed, actually. I mean, the Warhammer one was an unknown quantity to me, and it was literally just me and the editor.
And will they even know what Warhammer is?
Exactly.
So what for our listener, what is Warhammer?
Warhammer is a science fiction, it's a kind of science fantasy universe. It's like medieval fantasy in space. Originated as a game of tabletop warfare, so miniatures.
Also like Dungeons and Dragons.
It's a bit like that, it's war game, I suppose, basically. Yeah. But the universe has been so enriched and developed by fiction and background material over the years.
And I know there's written books and all
there
sorts
is.
Of
there's
things,
loads of novels. I've written a few, in fact. And again, as I say, loads of background material. And computer games as well, really big now. And there hasn't been any comics for quite a while set in the Warhammer universe. Titan recently got the license from Games Workshop, and because I've got a relationship with the material, asked me to write them.
Fantastic.
And we had a huge audience of well-attended well-informed people with great
really
questions.
That's really good, isn't it?
And people dressed as space marines.
Is it? I've no clue.
Yeah, it is.
Right.
I've come across it before. Go on, sorry, you were saying.
No, I was just saying that Warhammer is pretty big in the States.
I've come across it because my nephew, when he was growing up, quite a few years ago now, really wanted these things for Christmas. So I remember buying many sets for him to paint himself and, to play with. So I have come across it. But they also did in Games Workshop that they used to? They used to actually do live playing the game, didn't they?
They still do,
yeah,
I think.
They still
you can,
do
you can,
it.
You can take your collection in and play games with other people.
That's amazing, isn't it? That's amazing.
Fantastic.
So what's the thing that sort of really stands out for you about the San Diego show then? Was there any thing in particular?
I think the thing for me, as a creator, the real action for me was in the bars rather than in the convention, because it was where all the editors and other creators were.
Okay.
But as a consumer, I think actually the thing for me was that I was completely snowblind because there was so much.
I barely spent
any money in the convention. Mm. I went and bought presents for my kids from Hot Topic because A, the queues to get to the stands, and B, because I just didn't know where to look. Yes. And that was one of the really interesting
things. You're not sort of deluged with freebies like you are at some of these sort of trade shows and stuff where they give you bags full of books or toys or...
Depends on where you go.
That doesn't tend to happen. So the film companies aren't kind of giving you out screener discs or...
Very few of them, photographs or whatever.
A few
free comics from some stands, really, but or postcards and things, but nothing substantial. Mm. Nothing you'd take home and say, "This is a present for your son," or "This is something I'm going to cherish." You have to buy those.
Oh, that's awesome! Mm. And we'll come back to that. But first, a little bit of the theme tune from Stranger Things by Kyle Dixon and Michael Stein. Now, oh, Stranger Things, let's talk about that. It is a series that is an original on Netflix. Correct me if I'm wrong, David. And we've been watching it recently, and with all of these things, because it's available on Netflix, it's very easy to just stream things and watch it one after the other, which is also a very interesting way of watching things. Anybody here seen it?
Well, I've seen a couple of episodes. I'm really enjoying it.
Hmm. So what about you,
George? It's on my list. In fact, I said to Fiona last night, I really want to get into Stranger Things, but we've been away, so I haven't had a chance.
No, it's a fascinating series. I mean, Sam and I watched it sort of an episode a night, basically.
We did.
So I think it's 7 episodes or 8 episodes.
Yeah, might be.
So we watched it over 8 nights. I found it absolutely riveting. I thought it was very well done, very well put together. We've just had a sort of a blast of the theme tune there, which, as people have said, is kind of quite redolent of John Carpenter and his themes for his films, Halloween, Fog, Escape from New York, so on and so on, Christine, things like that. And it's a great kind of grab bag mishmash of a lot of different tropes and ideas and things that you kind of think, oh, I've seen something like that before.
Yes,
but
yes,
a lot of that. But it's actually not quite what you think you might have seen
before. So it's been inspired by lots of things.
Yes.
I mean, without giving away any spoilers, I mean, at first I felt it was something, the first couple of episodes for me were a different thing altogether to what it ended up being.
Yes.
It had a different feel after the third or fourth episode.
Oh.
And it very much became a little bit of not even teen adventure, but youngster's adventure, which reminded me an awful lot of It. It reminded me of The Goonies.
I was about to ask about The Goonies, because that's kind of what it looks like to me.
It really seems to be kind of like a
more horrific version of The Goonies in some respects.
Yes,
But with touches of Stephen King's It.
It's obviously a lot darker. But,
it's a lot darker, but I think that's coming about because the four, I suppose, main protagonists are kids in it.
Mm.
And I think they're all very, very good. I think that they're excellently acted. I think they're very well played. They do a very good job of what they have to do in terms of the narrative. The other thing I particularly liked about it was that it was simple. Mm. We watch so many of these things and so many films where there are so many characters that you lose track even in an episode of, well, who was that? Was that his mother, or was that that with the wife of the police chief? And there's so many characters that you honestly can't remember who these characters are from one episode to the next.
I think actually that's probably what I didn't like about it. Mm. And that was the interesting thing, because we both watched this and I have a love-hate relationship with it. I sort of liked it. I wanted to watch it to see where it went. But I felt it was disappointing at the end. And I thought, although David will totally disagree with me on it.
Yeah, I do.
But I didn't like how simple it was. And I did feel I was watching a kid's adventure story all the way through after once that became...
I thought it was great. I liked the simplicity. Another source that occurs to me is Poltergeist. Because in Poltergeist, of course, you have the boy that goes through the portal into the kind of the other world, and they have to go in after him to try and rescue him, and they all fall out the ceiling in a pile of gunk.
But it's still very much an adult thing, though. It's the adults driving that.
It is.
It's not the kids doing the adventure. Maybe it's just me.
I've been told, and I haven't actually looked online to find this yet, that online there are... as a documentary or there are websites which detail all the different homages and all the different little elements that go into Stranger Things, which are referencing film and so on and so on. And again, I was reminded of a series called Spaced, which I'm sure you've probably seen, Spaced, Simon Pegg's series Spaced.
I've seen that, no.
Where that too is comprised of literally thousands of references. Yeah. To film and television and history and all this stuff. And I think on the DVDs there's even a track which, an homageometer or something, which brings up references to all of these things in the series. And I think Stranger Things is a bit like that, in that all these things that you're seeing that you think is, oh, I've seen that before, actually, yes, you have, and actually it's quite deliberate that they've done it like that.
I think this is something that, to be honest, and I'm sure George will agree with me on this, that as writers we kind of do anyway. Sometimes we deliberately pay homage to, or sometimes we take a piece of art that we've really liked and change it, but be inspired by it, don't we, do something different with it? We do it all the time.
Everything. I mean, you know, Doctor Who and Sherlock Holmes are really obvious things in everything.
Absolutely.
I write, because... They've informed my creative kind of interior, I suppose. Well, the thing that I'd heard about Stranger Things, correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's very much a love letter to the 80s.
Yes.
From the production design all the way through to those tributes you talked about.
The whole thing.
It did feel like
down
it was
to
that.
The font that they use in the title sequence. It's very nostalgic, very kind of 80s. It's like the 80s filmed by modern people.
Yes.
But they did have mobile phones in it, didn't they?
Did they?
No,
what was I remember?
They've got walkie-talkies.
They have walkie-talkies.
Walkie-talkies,
they have
that's
a walkie-talkie.
It.
ET style.
Yeah.
Yes. Big thing, big brick.
Because for a while, I think I was a little confused about that, because I thought it was just one of those really sort of old-fashioned type American towns, and so the way they looked and were dressing and behaving was because it was a bit old-fashioned. And so
there
it took me a few episodes to
like that.
Exactly, and it took me a while to realise it was actually meant to be set in the 80s.
I think, as somebody said to me, is and maybe you'll agree, Patricia, because you've seen this much at least, is if you just watch the pre-title sequence from episode one, it's you just want to watch on because it is so...
Yes.
Interesting, scary, disturbing, you know, clever. You know, there's a monster hunting in the woods.
Like, ooh,
and what is this? And what's going on? And who's the monster?
And
why is it there? What's happening?
And George is looking at my face because I'm like going, no. I'm shaking my head. Going, but you see, to me, it wasn't terrifying enough. I suspect that's why. If I'd have been writing it, it would have gone a hell of a lot further. It really would. But I think that's all we have time for on that for the moment. But I would like to say, before we play the next track, that I'd like to thank the composer Debbie Ohi, we think is her name, and the composer Errol Ellumier for permission to play a song which was written after Ray Bradbury passed away, and it's called Homecoming. Quite a nice song too.
My mother looks into the sky, I think she hears him coming, but the stars are blinding her, so she cannot see. Help me keep him home. this time, she says to me, he's coming home. My father walks into the house, we laugh in his embrace. The scent of fire and stardust cling to his hands and face. Already we are wondering how long he'll stay this time. I hear the stars, they are calling tonight. Listen, can't you hear them? I hear the stars, they are calling tonight. Calling me home, calling me home. He takes us to the carnival, and swimming in the ocean, we picnic in the mountains, our faces to the sun. Each moment is a gift I take with me, a memory. My father sits beside me, his laughter ringing true. What's it like in space, I ask, as I always do. His eyes grow distant and he smiles, but Mom, she looks away. Before my father leaves, he takes me aside, and he says, the next time I come back, I won't be leaving. Tell your mother that I love you both. I am coming home. I hear the stars, they are calling tonight. Listen, can't you hear them? I hear the stars, they are calling tonight. Calling me home, calling me home. In the fading sunset, the message comes next day. His ship fell into the sun, a blaze of gold and gray. I try to tell Mom, but she turns away and goes inside. My mother looks into the sky. I think she hears him coming, but the stars are blinding her, so she cannot see. The winds are cold, I hear them whisper to me, he's coming home.
What a lovely song, Homecoming. And we're going to take that straight over to Patricia's Corner now and find out, what have you been doing this month, Patricia? What have you been reading?
I've been reading books. Lots of books. last month or the month before, we talked a little bit about writing books in an established series like Star Trek or like Doctor Who. And I thought I would talk about that from a reader's perspective, because I picked up a Star Trek book at a charity shop, and because it looked interesting, and then I read it, and it was interesting.
So what did you like so much about this book?
Well, I picked it up because it's by Barbara Hambly, who is one of my favorite authors, and Where was I going with that? I don't know.
You picked anyway. Up with Barbara Hambley, one of your favourite authors.
I got distracted. Somebody did a thing.
That happens in the studio. Stop doing that thing.
Yeah, I picked it up and I read it. I really like the way she captures the it's original series Star Trek, so it's Spock and Kirk and all those people. I really
fantastic.
Like the way she captures those characters. Like it's different from reading a totally original book because you've got the voices already in your head, which sounds a little wrong, but you've got those voices already in your head. You know how these characters sound.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
When it's done right, like it is in, let's see, this is called Ishmael. Like when it's done right, you can just hear them talking. It's like watching a very long episode of whatever it is that the book is in the series of.
So it feels like an episode of original Star Trek.
Yep.
When you read it.
Yes.
Is what you're basically saying. So is that a good thing?
Yes.
Why?
If you like the original series of Star Trek, it's a good thing.
I
if
love the original Star Trek.
I've been rewatching them recently.
They're amazing.
Yeah, there's so many of the original series that I hadn't actually seen that I just heard about. So now they're on Netflix. I'm watching them.
They're amazing.
Have you watched the animated series as well? Because it's amazing.
I saw a couple of episodes of it, but
I love it.
Haven't really gotten to
it's
that
the original movie. Cast doing yes. the voices.
Yes. Oh wow!
So now, what interests me about the whole subject, and we may have to come back to this in a future edition of the Stone Tapes, is as far as I understand it, with the Star Trek tie-in novels. They were very, very careful when they did their Bible or whatever it is that they give to the authors, that you do not disrupt the existing continuity. In other words, at whatever point you start the book must be the point at which you end the book. So you cannot introduce a new character and have them at the end. You cannot kill a character and have them dead at the end. You cannot disrupt the status quo.
That might be why this one goes back in time.
You see. And so you get this, they have to be a bit more clever with the way that they're dealing with things. I remember that there is one of the Star Trek, because there's obviously hundreds and hundreds of Star Trek novels. In one of them, they wanted to do a trilogy. And the reason they wanted to do a trilogy was because they wanted to kill, I don't know, Kirk or Spock or something in the first book, but then that's resolved by the time you get to the end.
I see.
Right.
But it gives you a novel in which, when you reach the end of that first novel, you're going, "Oh my goodness me, I need to read on." But it still fulfilled their need to have it not disrupting the continuity at all. The interesting thing about that is that the Doctor Who novels actually quite deliberately disrupted continuity. When they were doing the original novels, it was like, Doctor Who isn't on anymore. Take it, run with it, do what you like. So you can have new companions, companions could die, characters could come and go. You know, that there was a continuity within the books, but it certainly wasn't a case of you cannot hit a reset button.
Whereas now that I think the books do have to...
Do they?
Yeah, effectively.
Yeah, they do.
Books and comics... We say they put the toys back in the pram at the end.
Right.
Make a mess, but you have to tidy up.
But it's interesting the way that that works and the way that that happens in terms of these series and stuff like that.
Interesting.
It's absolutely fascinating. But you've enjoyed the book, I assume, because Barbara
is,
I think, an exceptionally good author.
Oh, yes.
I mean, you read her original novels as well. They are brilliant.
Those are fantastic.
Yes.
And she wrote this one, so I thought, this is interesting. Mm. And it was. Spock found some Klingons doing something shady.
On the starboard bow.
Hopped on their ship, did some spying, kind of got caught. They went back in time. The Klingons did to Earth, of all places, in 1867, of all years.
Oh, wow.
In Seattle.
Okay.
Which was at the time...
Nirvana.
Pretty much...
No.
It's in Washington. It was pretty much a logging camp, and that was about it. There was like four buildings. So they went back in time, accidentally kind of brought Spock with them. He lost his memory because Vulcan psychic things.
Interesting.
I think we are definitely going to have to come back to this subject in a future
show. There is so much we can talk about on it. I mean, from a reader's perspective, Was continuity an important issue in this when you were reading this book, or didn't it matter at all?
Didn't matter at all.
So that's a sign of a good, well-written book, then.
I just wanted to find out what happened next.
It was one adventure, which actually is very in the theme of Star Trek Original Series itself.
Yeah,
I think we talked about that before, haven't we? Yeah. Where they're self-contained stories. Mm. Absolutely awesome. That was Rush, The Body Electric, and after this next trailer, we'll be joining John Gilbert, editor of Fear Magazine.
Are you interested in video games? If so, be sure to join me, Jake, on the Cyber Den, your weekly dose of tech and games. Treat yourself to the latest news, interviews, some brilliant music, and much more. After all, it is approved by...
me, Duke Nukem.
Kane from Command and Conquer.
Agent 47.
Colonel Roy Campbell.
And more. So join me, Jake, on the Cyber Den. Every Wednesday, 10 till 12.
On Siren FM, 107.3.
So those of us with a long memory of horror magazines and with a great love of horror, remember a magazine called Fear, which actually started in July 1988 and then finished in October 1991. It was a tremendous magazine, presented film coverage, but more importantly, it presented book coverage and literary coverage of horror in novels and short stories and all sorts of things. The magazine was edited by one Mr. John Gilbert, and I'm delighted that John has joined us on the line today. Hello, John.
Hello there, how are you?
I'm very well, how are you doing?
Very well indeed, thank you, yes.
Fantastic. So Fear magazine, John, I mean, that was quite a long run back in the day. Were those good times?
Oh, very good, very good. I think one of the big perks was being able to go along to... film sets and being able to interview all your sort of favourite stars, and yes, it was great. It was absolutely great.
And I think it was great for us readers as well, because we finally had a magazine which actually covered the things that, you know, horror fans wanted to see covered, not just film but also the literary side and the authors and the books, and that was always very important to you, wasn't it?
That was my main interest. There were two things, really. One was that the magazine would be written by fans for fans. So that was always the proviso, that people who worked for it were fans. The other thing was, I'm a massive fan of authors, books, the whole literary scene. And that was the area that I wanted to cover. So that, back then and now, that's the big theme of the magazine. Whereas others can cover films and they can do the big blockbusters, we're interested in covering the things that fans really love, which is the creative process, the ideas behind the horror and the fantasy side of things.
And that's absolutely fantastic. And of course, you mentioned there then and now, because Fear is actually back.
Yeah, absolutely. It's taken how many years? But
1991 was the last issue.
a long time. So yes, we tried a couple of occasions with digital issues and with sort of A5 smaller sort of pocket books, but none of those worked, and so I had to come up with something a little original in order to get it back into action again.
So that the first of these new issues that are just hitting the newsstands at the moment. This is obviously harking back to the magazine as it was in the past, but again giving us some incredible coverage of some of the great writers and some of the great people that are involved in sort of making horror in a literary sense. So tell us a bit about the magazine, John. What delights, to coin a Hellraiser phrase, what delights do you have to show us?
Right. Well, there are a lot of author interviews coming up, and combined, obviously, with film writers and film directors, people who sort of cross over. And so they've written books, but they've also directed films. A lot of people do that these days. I mean, we've got people like Mick Garris, who's heavily into Stephen King. We've got writers like Ray Garton, Stephen Gallagher, Raymond Feist. We're doing the gamut between fantasy and horror mainly. People like Angela Slatter, who is an amazing author. Absolutely. Every issue will be jam packed with not just with author interviews, but also with artist interviews. So we're looking at people who who produce the artwork for the books and their sort of raison d'etre, why they do it, how they got involved. So the whole thing is not just about covering the book or the film or whatever. It's also about how people got involved in the genre. And really, I mean, that's a dream for most people. How do I get involved? And so we're trying to allow people that sort of the exposure to the sort of creative process and ways to get into it.
Because I think it's something that we've kind of all done over our lifetimes, in a way, is that, you know, that the horror bug bites at an early age. You know, whether it's, I mean, for me, it was staying up late at night and watching the double bill horror films on BBC Two back in the day. I mean, these days, I guess, people are coming to horror and looking at, we were just talking about Stranger Things on the show. And that's a great kind of Netflix horror series, which is starring children and stuff. So there's a lot of ways that you can come to it. But once the bug has bitten, it's then, how can I express that? Do I want to do my own magazine? Do I want to make my own films? And of course, these days, anyone with an iPhone can make a film in their back garden. There's an incredible inventiveness around the whole genre.
Absolutely. And I think there's an opening for everybody. You know, the horror genre is growing again, and so people are looking for new material. And okay, there are the classics, which will always be around, but there are new writers, fantastic new writers, that the bigger magazines, and I, you know, we're a fairly small fish in the big pond at the moment. The bigger magazines tend to cover the blockbusters. They won't really touch the authors unless the authors are somehow involved in a movie or so they're casting the nets wide. What we're doing is we're focusing so that people who come to us can really see, as I say, that creative process and be invited to get involved and perhaps become writers themselves.
I think it's an incredible endeavor, John, and you know, Fear magazine was very much a part of, you know, the genre back in the day, and I'm so glad to see it back. So how can people find out some more about it? Where can they go to sort of buy copies or find out how to contribute or whatever?
Yeah, we're always looking for contributors. Best place to start is our website online. At the moment, we're looking for, it's really good news, we're looking at distributors not only in this country but also in the States. About 12% of our readership at the moment is in the States. So the best thing to do is head over to the website, if I can give that URL out, which is www.fear-magazine.com, and all the details there about how to contact us, how to get a subscription, or even how to contribute to us. It's all there. It's all there. So, and they can also write to me if they want to via email, if you don't mind me giving out my email address.
Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. It's john.gilbert@fear-magazine.com, and I will always write back.
That's fantastic, John. I mean, you have been such a major contributor to all of this over the years, and it's just fantastic to see the enthusiasm for the written word, you know, continuing in the present day. And as you said, there are so many incredible authors out there and so much incredible writing. That it is, it's actually quite amazing that there is a magazine that will champion, that will promote, that will show the very best that we've got out there, both in sort of independent and mainstream and everything, in film and television and book and everything. So it's an incredible thing, John. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for your time, John. Thank you. I'm going to pass back now. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends. See you.
Oh, what a cold surprise the flying horses cried. And didn't anybody want to ask the calliope to call the tune? The flying horses crooned, but did not know.
After a bit of Medicine Man, Barclay James Harvest, we're going to head over to David's Film of the Month. Something Hello. Wicked This Way Comes.
Yes, and I'm coming closer and closer and closer.
And it's getting very creepy.
Yes, I'm sorry about that, guys. So, yes, Ray Bradbury theme music, and we chose Medicine Man by Barclay James Harvest because that song is actually all based on Something Wicked This Way Comes. It's yeah. The song's kind of all based around the film. So, yeah, the film, Something Wicked This Becomes, a 1983 film, directed by Jack Clayton, and quite strangely produced by Walt Disney. And it's really not a film that you would expect Walt Disney to have actually produced. Ray Bradbury wrote the screenplay from one of his stories, or his novel of the same name. And the film had an incredibly difficult gestation, as one will discover. Starred Jason Robards as Charles Halloway, Jonathan Pryce, who was amazing as Mr. Dark.
Yeah.
I'll agree with
that. He was absolutely amazing.
Brilliant.
And then the two kid leads, the child leads, was Videl Peterson and Sean Carson as Will and Jim. And I think they were excellent as well. They were very, very good. And then it's got a whole load of other people as well, Diane Ladd, Roald Dano, Pam Grier, lots of other people appearing in it as well. So the film... It is like a bit of a dark nightmare in a way, in that it's two kids living in a small town, and everyone in this town has kind of got their own hidden wish, in that the guy that runs the bar has lost an arm and a leg, and he's a sort of an ex-baseball player, and he longs for the days when he could, he was a baseball star, and that the barber, you know, longs to sort of be beautiful and have people tend to him rather than whatever else. And so all these people have kind of got these hidden secrets. The teacher is very old and longs for the days when she was young and pretty and all this sort of thing. So Mr. Dark's pandemonium carnival kind of
young and pretty, Sam.
rolls into town. And one of the things that the carnival does is it kind of entraps people. It gives them their heart's desire. So the old school teacher, she looks in a mirror and she kind of becomes beautiful again, mm-hmm. but she's then blind. So she's beautiful, but she can't see her own beauty.
She only sees it for a second, doesn't she?
She only sees it for a second, and then it's taken from her because she's blind. The baseball player kind of reverts to a child again. So he's kind of, he longed for his glory days, etc., but they actually take him back to before it even happened.
Yeah.
So it arguably never happened. And so he never had his glory days, but he's got his arm and his leg back. And it's very much, it's a very Stephen King-esque, but actually this was Ray Bradbury long before Stephen King wrote about this kind of stuff. So this is kind of Bradbury doing what Bradbury did best and kind of evoking this dark autumn kind of feeling throughout the film. A carnival horses, which when you run them backwards makes time go backwards and runs you back to a child, and one of the carnies gets taken back so he can kind of entice the school teacher in. It's a lovely kind of almost metaphorical film in a way.
I think there's a lot of that, and one of the things I felt that the film lost a little bit off from the book was that autumnal thing.
Yes.
Because there's a real story of the father in there, isn't there?
Mm.
And he's in the autumn of his life, and that's the point of the autumnal kind of
the allegory
environment,
through,
and the allegory coming through. And I think the film lost a little bit of that autumnal feeling.
And I think that was in the nightmare of the making. I mean, I've got a few notes. I mean, it goes on for pages and pages on Wikipedia. But, I mean, the film, the script was interfered with without Bradbury's knowledge, and the studio didn't like it. They sacked the director. They got in a new director. They refilmed. They spent $5 million refilming bits of the film.
$5 million?
Yeah. They got rid of bits here. They got rid of bits there. There were whole sequences that were cut. There was apparently two sequences. One sequence is when the train rides in.
Right.
There was an early piece of CGI in the film, and what CGI remains in the film, I think, is brilliant.
Yeah.
It's for its time, very early. It's very, very nice what's there. But when the train rides into town, the idea was that the train would become the carnival. So the smoke from the train would become the guy ropes, and the train would become the caravans, and the big top would kind of emerge. And
that's
so
nice.
The,
amazing,
the thing would
it?
Kind of like organically grow.
Mm.
That all got left completely. There was another scene, which was replaced in the film by the scene with the spiders in the bedroom, which I cannot watch, even to this day. I cannot watch the film without closing... the tarantulas in both.
You have a problem with tarantulas?
I have a spider with tarantulas. I cannot stand spiders.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So the boys' room gets invaded by hundreds of tarantulas. It's horrible, horrible, horrible.
They're in the bed. It's kind of... It's very scary.
They're real tarantulas, aren't they?
They're real tarantulas. They're not CGI ones. They're horrible, real tarantulas. But the original idea was that Mr. Dark is hunting for these kids. So he sends a vast hand to come and grab the kids in the bedroom. And they actually built an animatronic vast hand, but they didn't think it worked very well, so they cut that whole thing and instead replaced it with an invasion by spiders.
I think the spiders are scarier than
they
the
are
giant.
Scarier. I agree with you, but the film had a very, very rocky road. Even the score was replaced. It had an original score, which again Disney thought was too scary, so they replaced it with a James Horner score.
Right.
Because what Disney were trying to do, they wanted to make a family-friendly film. The way that Wikipedia puts it is that they'd seen things like Time Bandits and Dark Crystal and thought, we want to do a film like that. And so they chose Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Maybe if you want to do a film like Dark Crystal, don't have Ray Bradbury write it.
I find it a very evocative film. I find it very watchable. I think the performances are very, very good. It's not a perfect film. It's not. It's not as good as it perhaps could have been. But it is still, it's got that certain something.
I think there's a really interesting thing for me as well. I loved it, but I think it looks like a Disney film.
Yeah.
It does.
Especially when it starts. It feels like it, it's almost like it's behind a filter, like Pete's Dragon or something. Yes. And then you see the kids and the nice kind of slow voiceover at the start leading you in this small town America.
It's
and
a
you
bit
think,
Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah, it was. Exactly. And I was like, I'm in Disneyland.
The beginning, it reminds me of A Christmas Story.
Yes, idyllic thing.
When I was 12 years old, I did this thing.
The Field of a Thousand Pumpkins. Yes.
Which we don't actually see. I kind of felt cheated.
Yeah, absolutely.
So but what did you feel about the film overall, though?
I liked it. It left me a little bit confused. Mm-hmm. I would say overall 7 out of 10.
Uh-huh. And Sam, what were your feelings?
I liked it, but I didn't like the casting of very old people for parents of what looked like a 9-year-old boy. They should have been grandparents, not parents. I felt the casting was really bad for that. But I think that was typical of the era, that parents had to be old.
And I think that was originally, I think that's part of the thing that's missing from the book in the translation, because in the father's story is that he feels that he's too old, and the thing that he wants the carnival to give him is youth backs. So he can be young with his son and run around with his son. And he learns to do it anyway, and I think that's and that's how he defeats them. And that's that kind of... Yeah. journey for him.
But that isn't so clear, is it?
No,
I mean,
it's
if
not.
You haven't read the story, you perhaps wouldn't get that from the narrative.
So what would you give it out of 10, George?
8.5
I think I'm probably about 8.5, 9
I think about 8 for me.
So that's Something Wicked This Way Comes. It's quite hard to find. So
Jonathan Price was superb.
He was brilliant.
Agreed, yes.
Well, we'll leave it there on Something Wicked.
And that's all we've got time for. So thanks so much to David J. Howe, Patricia H. Ash, George Mann, our phone-in guest, John Gilbert, and especially to our producer, Alex Lepchuk. Till next time. Strong.